Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dream Girls opened on Broadway in 1981. You still have a little while to see it in Milwaukee, and a terrific production performed by the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. It will be at the Quadracci Powerhouse Theater until November 1st. It is the sixth musical production done by the Rep, and it's really, it's so well done. It is the story of Motown. It's the story of Payola. It's the story of black artists trying to be heard and black artists becoming important in the whole music industry, but being denied being able to play in places like Miami until our guest this hour, who plays a loose version of Berry Gordy in this film, or other managers, pushes and pushes to get some of these Motown acts in Miami and in other places where mostly white performers have been. Well, you know, I got to tell you, the performances are just outstanding. The music is wonderful. The setting is great. The lighting and the costumes are really good. We'll talk about why it is that it still draws large crowds, the messages of this. Is it just a musical, or does it have a lot more to it? Are there messages that we all need to hear? Jared Joseph is with us in our studios in Milwaukee. He's in the production. He plays Curtis Taylor Jr., and he is making his Milwaukee Rep debut. He's been on Broadway in Holler, If You Hear Me, The Book of Mormon, in national tours of Dream Girls and The Book of Mormon. Regional theater credits include the West Coast premiere of The Scottsboro Boys, and he was in the Kansas City Rep Theater's new concept production of Hair. He's also partnering with an organization which we want to talk about sometime this hour, that ignites global dialogue among the leaders of tomorrow by creating artistic, educational, and ensemble-building opportunities for disenfranchised youth. Jared, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great performance. It was it was great. So is this just a feel-good kind of musical, or is there some reason why this show, it opened in 1981, is still being performed now and has some kind of resonance?
Well, I think because it's an American story, it really is. It's Motown, even if we want to believe that Motown is the basis of this musical, it is an American story. This start from the bottom and rise to the top and rise to international acclaim and appeal, you know? And I think that that's one thing that people see and resonate with. And the characters, the characters that evoke ideas of the Supremes, Diana Ross, you know, James Brown and Little Richard and all of these people that these types of performers that we know, you know, to see them on stage live and in person, and in some ways get to understand a bit about the behind the scenes, the journey that it took to get to that place. And then also the questions of what did it cost for them to get there? You know, what did it cost for them to dream? What did it cost for them to leave their families or you know, to gain the world's appreciation? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? The world's focus on them. What did that cost? You know, and I think that that's the questions that at least inspire me working on this production. And I've done it before. The last time that I did it.
Same role?
No, not the same role. It's the first time that I've ever done Curtis. But I had the pleasure of doing it in the tour that came through Milwaukee in 2010, directed by Robert Longbottom. And it was another production, and I'm thinking 5 years later, being here and going with the show again, with the journey of the show, it still means a lot to me, you know, which is one of the reasons why I chose to do it, you know.
Yeah, it takes so much out. It's such a requiring everything of you kind of show, isn't it? You're singing, you're dancing, it's love lost, it's manipulation, all of it is just high energy. I really don't know what it takes to be able to do that day after day, and sometimes you're doing two shows a day. How do you do that? How do you summon? What do you do for yourself to be able to summon that kind of here I am kind of presence?
Well, a lot of us have been doing this for a long time, you know, and it's the discipline and learning how to perform consistently night after night, and also to take care of ourselves and our instruments, and training those things, keeping them in tune and staying in shape and staying on top of all of that, you know. Those are things that we learn. Those are things that you must pick up in order to have longevity. And the thing that allows us to do it again, 8 times, sometimes 9 shows a week. Last week we had a 9-show week, 9 shows in 5 days, which is unheard of. And it does pull a lot out of us, and even more reason to try to be as on top of our health and our instruments as possible. Yeah. And really, that's what it is, you know?
There must be a little bit of what happens in this show that resonates with all of the performers, because your lives are really difficult, too. You're traveling all over the country all the time. You're rehearsing. You're giving up very stable, I live in a certain city, and this is where I live. You're all over the place.
Yeah.
So there must be something that you see yourself in a little bit in these performers who've made it to the pinnacle, who are billionaires, you know, some of them. But there is something about that life that resonates for you, isn't there?
Yeah, the show is also about showbiz. Mm-hmm. And in America, especially in modern culture, we're so infatuated by fame.
Right.
And I think that this show is so great because it's one of the first times that we were actually able to see what that actually meant, you know, from the fame show, you know, fame costs, you know what I'm saying? You know, it's that thing. And what does it cost again, you know? And to be a performer and to also have the moment of seeing it from a different perspective, I am primarily, my career has primarily been in the theater, which is a different thing than the music industry. And it's a different thing being in the music industry back then in the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, and so it is an educational piece for me as a person,
mm-hmm.
outside of a performer, but as a person. It's also a show that black people are glamorous in. You know, we're not just field workers, or we're not just, you know, our ties are rooted in the slave narrative. We're glamorous people, which is a large part of the experience as well, especially as it pertains to show business. And to actually have that glamour being married to a story, a narrative, and that story and narrative isn't necessarily a black story, it's an American story.
Right.
It's so great. It's one of those things that I feel proud to be an American. Or at least, you know, it's one of those moments, you know. And as a performer, to have the opportunity to in some ways embody and experience this phenomenon that was black music, and black music in the tradition, in the ways that Motown allowed it mm-hmm. to expand, is just, it's incredible. It's incredible to step into that nightly. And it's also sobering, because we then see some of the things that these performers, or we can imagine some of the journeys that they had to take, and how heartbreaking it is, and the people that are lost in the shuffle, you know, for dreams, you
right
know?
Well, and it's part of what, when you look at the best of motivations for the character you play, Curtis, part of what he's doing, it seems to me, is to make this Motown sound, to make African-American music and voices and faces part of that American dream. I mean, we're talking about a time when you couldn't play in lots of venues, that it was very much a segregated, incredibly segregated society, and certainly Motown helped integrate us in some way. So you can see that in your character. I mean, he's a complicated character, isn't
yes,
he?
God.
But that's part of who he is.
Absolutely. I think that at the end of the day, Curtis is a visionary, and that has everything to do with dreaming. And I think that he is a character that doesn't want to just be limited in his existence. And he sees that this music, this captivating music, can actually have appeal to a broader audience. And how can that happen? How can we get us into the places that we should be in? You know, because it's not a lack of ideas or a lack of talent or a lack of anything else. I mean, it was systematic, the ways in which black performers were kept out of certain venues, and their songs were taken and remade, and money was put into those, the remakes, and those people never got credit. There are countless songs. And one song that I even was exposed to recently, what's the Janis Joplin record that's so famous? Take Another Little Piece of My Heart.
Right.
That was first recorded by Irma Franklin, which is Aretha Franklin's sister.
Really? I didn't know that.
And Irma Franklin's version is so... I mean, Janis's version is so similar to Irma's version. And to hear, it's like, whoa. But then, for history's sake, Janis put that thing on it, which she did. But why don't we know that Irma Franklin sang the song
right.
first? You know, and that this was a cover, you know, why don't we know that? And I think that that's very interesting. And again, you know, it brings up a lot of that. And this show also, of course, focuses on that in a way, you know, for sure. It was a different time. And I think that Curtis definitely saw an opportunity and a crack that he could get into and to allow not only for the exposure, but then I think also for the business of it all, to actually be business people, you know, within the industry, to not just be puppets, not just be performers, but to take on a different life that includes having the power, the means, the money, but also the ownership of those materials that we did not have prior to the time that mm-hmm. I think Motown really took off.
Yeah. But there's also the, play a little bit of this song too, the bad side of this, so that, I mean, I remember the days in radio years ago when Payola was still going on and people had to, you know, if you worked for a radio station, you had to take a pledge and wrote something down, I think, where you wouldn't take payola for playing a certain song on the radio. And he has to do that. So you have to do some things that are bad, that are not legal, in order to become mainstream.
I have to play the game. It's what it is. And I say I, but Curtis has to play the game. Those are the rules of engagement. That's what's being done. And so why not play along? If they're not going to hear us being, they're not going to respect us being passive people. So we have to take ownership and empower ourselves. And is the choice necessarily one to, as it pertains to Curtis, and I'm not talking about Berry Gordy at all, I'm saying Curtis in the show, is it really so bad, you know? Is the decision so bad? Is it a bad thing, you know? I don't know if it necessarily is, because what he was able to do through those decisions was to create a whole empire that allowed
sure did.
A platform for so many people, and still to this day.
Yeah. You know? Set this up for us. We're going to play, because it is a musical, we wanted to play some of the music. Step Into the Bad Side, set it up for us. We'll hear some of this, and then we'll welcome phone calls, too. Let me invite our audience. I hope some of you listening to us have had a chance to see Dreamgirls at the Milwaukee Rep, or you've seen the show, or you just want to talk about some of the issues that we're discussing. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Jared Joseph, who plays Curtis Taylor Jr. in Dreamgirls, is with us. So this song, it was a great version of this song, too, on
awesome.
Stage. Tell us about it.
Well, this song comes right after, in the show, Jimmy Early, who... is the wildest man in show business. He is in fantastic play, So Beautifully by Cedric Neal. And he has just had a hit, and this hit was taken by a Pat Boone-type character and whitewashed and dumbed down. And this is the moment of, it comes right after a scene of just being angered and enraged by the realities of this business. And this song is about, again, playing the game as it is, and to take power and ownership of the songs that we create. And that's what this song is about.
Step into the bad side. 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 my woman from me. Took her down Tennessee. She was the best girl I ever knew. If it wasn't for him, she'd still be true. Always been a good man, it's been sad. When I catch the man here, wish he would dead. And like him, make good men mad. On the day I'm gonna be bad.
This hour, Dream Girls, it's at the Milwaukee Rep for a little while longer, and see it while you can. It's quite a show. Curtis Taylor Jr. is played by our guest, Jared Joseph. And as we were listening to that, in addition to dancing, you should see this guy dance even from a chair. you made a point about a line in that song that was important, I think.
Well, in the song, before the actual full song starts, is a line that says, that I say, you have to put your soul on a moral break, you know. And I think that that is very telling because of everything that we can imagine these people being, maybe one generation off from the Great Migration, being very church-going, very God-fearing, and being scared to do those type of things. And it's put it on a moral break in order to make change because, after all, you know, no revolution is peaceful. You know?
Yeah.
No revolution is peaceful.
So did you, when you look at descriptions of this, everybody says it's loosely based on the life of Berry Gordy. It's loosely based on the life of the Supremes. Do you take that history to inform you in this production, or is it enough of a loose connection that you're trying to not use that historical reference?
Well, yeah, I only refer to it really aesthetically. And I think the type of actor that I am, I actually believe that all of what I need is in the script, you know, and so I focus on what's in the text. Mm-hmm. I don't try to put too much onto it with outside sources, especially if they haven't been deliberately placed in the script. And I think this show... It takes the loose parts of this narrative as we imagine them to be and makes a fictional account that often reads as truth based on the things that we knew throughout time, his relationship, Berry Gordy I'm speaking of, and Diana Ross and their connection and how she and Diana Ross and the Supremes as opposed to the Supremes and her rise and all of those stories, you know. But I think they just take the biggest hot topic points of their careers and lives and mold them together to create this piece that I believe is definitely so very separate from the actual truth and legacy of the Motown sound, I mean the Motown record company and Berry Gordy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also think, just because of it, also captures so well the reproduction of this star quality when you talk about, you know, it's really a fancy production and fancy costumes, and you really get the sense that you're seeing these people rise in stardom.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, there are fans who are adoring and can't get enough of you, and you, how exhausting it must have been for people in the peak of their fame, and how sad once the fame is gone too. But it just, people can't get enough of you, right?
Yeah, to have this, to be, to you know, that's the thing. And that's the beautiful thing about this show. We start off small. We start off, this story starts off at a talent competition.
I know, at the Apollo Theater.
A little talent competition, you know. And that's a very famous, you know, night, of course, this idea of the amateur night at the Apollo, you know, this event. But we start off so humble, you know, and then we grow to being superstars. You know, and also people were very young. The characters are very young.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? It really is a show that makes me question what my dreams actually are. And it makes me step back and it sobers me up, because that life is very intoxicating. To have all of that, adoration, you know, and also to have this immense talent that you want to share, and then stardom, and of course fame is the word I keep on bringing up, but fame and all of this stuff, yeah, you know, it is a lot, you know, and it definitely costs a hell of a great deal for a lot of people. And then it clarifies itself for different artists, because what you thought was your dream actually wasn't. You needed more.
Mm-hmm.
In our show, Dina, she finds herself wanting more, you know. And I say, you're the most famous woman in the country, in the world, but you want more. Life meant something more to her, you know. And as life happens, of course, our dreams and our ideas, they change and they morph. And how do we deal with it? And what's the new dream?
And what about Curtis? What more does he want? He wants more too, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that Curtis wouldn't. I think that if I had to continue a trajectory for him, I think Curtis Taylor Jr. in his mind would want to be everywhere. I think he would want black performers, black artists to be everywhere and in every part of the entertainment industry, you know, whether that would be in food or, hell, cooking products or whatever, talk shows, anything. I think that he wouldn't have stopped until everyone in the country would not flinch at the idea of seeing someone of color in any arena.
Oh, interesting.
Because also in the show, we actually are at where the dream becomes real, I guess. We also go into a Democratic National Convention. So that tells me that he's branching into politics. He's branching into these worlds, you know, because he wants to be everywhere. He wants that dream to be fully realized. And I do wonder if it might have ever gotten the best of him, you know, as far as the business is concerned. Personally, personally, it did, you know. But
you know what came to mind when you were saying that? Obviously, she's a very different person, but Oprah came to mind, because I was watching this news report of Oprah buying, you know, $10 million of Weight Watchers and being on the board of Weight Watchers now yesterday, and they had, and Oprah's stamp is here and here and here and here and here, and I thought, oh my gosh, it is. She's just been amazingly powerful, amazingly powerful, and she's everywhere.
She's
the influence
everywhere.
Is everywhere.
She's everywhere, and it's so beautiful, and it's beautiful that, you know, while this show was done in 81, I mean, who would have thunk that we would be here even, you know, that one of the most powerful women in the world is a black woman.
Right.
And she's just it's not just Oprah. Oprah is a brand, a business. She employs thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
Millions of people benefit from the things that she and her team are able to do. And the fact that she's a brown face is so beautiful. And it does something that another name, you know, Shonda Rhimes, with the shows, that the great success that she's had with Grey's Anatomy and How to Get Away with Murder and Scandal and all the other things that she has her hand in, she says something that I love. She says, I'm not trying to diversify, I'm trying to normalize culture. And I think that that's so awesome. And I think that that's the legacy that even a show like this would want to continue. I'm normalizing culture, you know? We should be everywhere. And I say we, meaning everyone should be everywhere. There shouldn't be a place that anyone, especially not based upon color or sexual orientation or look or aesthetic, should not have access to.
Absolutely.
There shouldn't be. And I'm glad that we're living in a time that, you know, even for a young people, I would even say at the age of 11-year-olds who were too young to remember a time that there wasn't a black first family. They only know a black president. When I grew up, that was something that seemed not impossible, but seemed like a big thing. But you have kids who, that's their normal.
I know.
That's their
Isn't
new
that
normal.
Something? Isn't
that's
that something?
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, first of all, let me welcome the audience again. If you've seen the show or if you want to join our conversation, I don't mean to leave you out. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we do have lines open for you, 800-486-8655. But I do want to talk about some of the nitty-gritty business of how you do this kind of show. I went with my son to the show, and he really liked it, too. But at the end, he said, how in the world? How long did they rehearse for this? Which you would think would be a really, because you're doing dance moves you got to learn, and you're singing, and you're got a script that you have to learn. Is it a longer because of the nature of this production than doing a straight drama rehearsal process?
I just think that there are many more components and the stakes are higher because we have the element of dance. We have the element of a large ensemble. We have the element of fast moving costumes and sets. And on top of that, we have big songs and voices and things, and also a story that we have to act. There's so many components to it, and I think that's what makes the rehearsal time a bit more, it raises the stakes of the rehearsal period. And typically, I think we started maybe had 4 weeks of rehearsal.
Just 4 weeks, really.
I want to say that.
Oh,
I want to say 4 weeks of rehearsal. To put it up, it's a huge responsibility, and a huge taking. But yeah, I think it was 4 weeks. I think it was 4 weeks. We got here. Our first day of rehearsal was August 24th, and we started previews the 22nd of September, and that's including a week of tech. So you had to learn the show. Learn the choreography, and then we have a week of tech rehearsals, you know, that we're trying to get the technical parts, the mood, the lights, the sound, the everything right, you know, so that's another bit. But that's not running the show. That's going cue by cue,
right,
forming, you know, things. Yeah. So it was a short time. It was a short time.
I think you said earlier that your background, is it more not musical theater? It's more drama. Do you prefer doing one over the other? Because you're really, I mean, you're a great singer and dancer, too.
Thank you.
So do you like doing that, or you prefer doing something else?
I like telling stories. I'm a storyteller, you know? And if I can do that in song, I want to do that. If I can do that in dance, I want to do that. If I can do that in just acting in general, I want to do that. If I can do it all three, or, you know, whatever, I would love to do that as well. I just want to tell good stories, and I want to tell stories. If I have a preference, no, I think it just really depends on, it's less about the medium and more about the story. I've been really blessed in my career to be a part of some fantastic stories, you know, that range in variety, you know, and that's what's so cool about what I do and what I've chosen to do, is to have that opportunity. And whatever medium that means. You know, I'm down for it.
Yeah, I can tell you are. So tell me about this group that you're, what's the name of the group? This reaching out for young people?
Oh, Breaking Walls.
Working Walls.
Breaking Walls.
Breaking Walls.
Yes, Breaking Walls. It's an organization that was started by Fran Tarr. And the it's an organization that really speaks to a need that she discovered through her years of teaching in the inner city. For young kids in those environments to be able to have the tools in order to empower themselves and to start expressing themselves and to start reimagining their lives for the better. And it's a program that we go into schools and we have varies in the amount of weeks that we do. But we go into schools and do different writing exercises and prompts and different ways in which they can express themselves, but mostly through writing and reading and discussions. And it's just really an opportunity to allow young people to hear themselves and find the value in their voices. So many times young people are taught to be quiet and respect or just deal with it, you know, whatever they're going through. And with some school systems being different than others and not being as advanced, you know, there's more of a need for those students who are in those school systems to have the tools in which they can at least start asking questions and maybe seeing themselves in a different light, that they're not enslaved to their environment or their circumstances, that they actually can be Oprah. Mm. They can be a Berry Gordy. They can be a Barack Obama. They can be anyone, you know, Shonda Rhimes. They can be whoever. Mm-hmm. They can be whoever they want, and I think that's what's so important and so great about the work that we're doing with the organization.
And sometimes it seems to me as though it does take the world of art to be able to do that. It's through writing, it's through speaking, it's through plays, it's through all of those things that we're not paying attention to anymore.
No.
Instead, we're doing, you know, you better do well on this test, and you better do math, and you do English, and these are what we focus on, and all of the things that made school worthwhile for me, and I'm sure for you too.
Yeah.
That's how you find the course that you just described, through the arts.
And it honestly was, if I didn't have the arts in my education, you know, I don't know where I would really be or how I would have gotten to this place, because while my parents are fantastic. Love you, Mom. Love you, Dad. They're fantastic, and my family is as well. And they've always exposed my brother and I and my friends as well to art and, you know, going to operas and ballets, and music is always in the house, or plays and poetry and that type of thing. And also, as a young person, most of my days are spent in school. And so I was thankful that my school, where all the schools that I attended, you know, had some kind of arts program that we were able to do and express ourselves and get the things that maybe we can articulate out, you know, through different mediums. I started off as a visual artist.
You did?
Yeah,
really? Doing what?
Watercolor.
Really?
Finger painting, that type of stuff.
Huh.
Yeah, and sketching. That's what I started off as. I wasn't in love with words. I always loved music, but I didn't do it. I didn't really sing as a solo person. I was a part of like a little, you know, a little choir, but you know how kids we do. We talk, sing, or whatever, you know. And it it was a natural progression, but I was so thankful that I've had all of those many different mediums to express myself. And I think that with the program, with Breaking Walls, that's one of the things that we want to incorporate and to include and to provide young people with outlets, and to let them know that they actually have a choice.
Right.
You know, they're not confined by their circumstances. They can be whoever.
Yeah.
And go wherever.
Right. And all schools need to be really good schools, don't they? They're just not in this country.
You know, there is, I don't know if I can say that. I don't know if I can say that. I think that our schools are just, might be focused on the wrong things, similar to what you're saying, the tests, test scores and those things, and not taking into account that people learn many different ways. And it doesn't mean that they're disabled. It doesn't mean that they're dumb. It doesn't mean that they won't make it. It just means that we need to find out their introduction into learning for themselves, and not only just learning, but their retention rate and what they learn, you know? And I think a large part of it has to do with changing the pedagogy in this country and how we teach students and what we teach them about learning, as opposed to the things that we teach them. That's a whole nother topic of what we teach them. But right. The how they learned, you know, I think is one of the biggest things that we must tackle, and be available to many different ways of learning, and be and to have many different types of aptitude tests available, not just whatever, however each state to state or, you know, how they're doing it. Because I do believe that the tests are failing the students, especially students who learn differently.
Let's hear, this is actually not you singing this, but somebody probably from the Broadway. We're hearing music from Dreamgirls. We're talking, if you're just tuning us in, we're speaking with one of the leads in the Reps production of Dreamgirls, which is going on now until November 1st at the Quadracci Powerhouse. Jared Joseph plays Curtis Taylor Jr. He's making his Milwaukee Rep debut. He's been on Broadway, national tours, and regional theater all over the country. And this is one of your big songs in the show, When I First Saw You. Tell us what it's about. We'll hear it. And let me also welcome, this may be the kind of conversation that you don't want to call in on, but you're always welcome to call in. If you've seen the show, give us a call, 800-486-8655. This song is?
This song comes from a scene between Dina and I. Dina is the lead singer of the group The Dreams, and she is a Diana Ross type character, if we want to imagine her. And at this point, she has she's the most successful woman in the country, and she wants more, and she wants to act and be a different type of artist, and she essentially wants to leave and to start choosing for herself. And she believes that I don't love her, and I've never seen her for who she actually is. And so this is out of our personal relationship, the song You Are My Dream.
When I first saw you, I said, oh my, I said, oh my, that's a dream, that's my dream. I needed a dream when it all seemed to go bad. Then I found you, and I have had the most beautiful dreams any man's ever had. When I first saw you, I said, oh my, oh my, that's my dream, that's my dream. I needed a dream to make me strong. You were the only reason I had to go on. First saw you, I said, oh my, oh my, that's my
talking about Dreamgirls now with the Milwaukee Rep, and I dropped something, sorry. And we're talking with Jared Joseph, who plays Curtis Taylor Jr., and that is one of his signature songs in the program. That was sung by Jimmy Fox, but Curtis is much better. I mean, really is. He has a much more nuanced, lovely interpretation of the song, I think.
Thank you.
And as you said, it's it really does show that this guy isn't all bad, really. He loves her.
He loves her, and he loves her. I believe that to be true. And again, you know, she embodied his dream. you know, this woman, and she seemingly wants that dream, that same dream, you know? And I think it's a great moment in the show, for
yeah,
sure. One of the first times we get him vulnerable.
And there are some performances, too, that are, I think it was, let me find what this quote is, Frank Rich, who, you know, did theater and mostly theater reviews for the New York Times for so many years, called Effie's show-stopping Act One finale, and I am telling you, I'm not going, the greatest Broadway musical moment since Ethel Merman's Everything's Coming Up Roses, which I thought was interesting. It is an incredible moment. Which one are you singing?
It's time for me, buddy.
It was, to tell you the truth, I didn't know the storyline of Dreamgirls. I knew what it was about, but I'd never seen the show before. And that song really is, I think he's probably right about it. It is just the way that it hit the audience.
It's heart-wrenching.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and I mean, it's so brilliantly played by Nova Payton.
Yes.
Who's our Effie. And I mean, if anything else, trust me, you need to go and see these performers on stage. And not just about me, but we have so many great performances. But Nova and Cedric, who play Jimmy and Effie, who represent a soul sound and soul music, really do such a phenomenal job in the production. Everyone does. The cast is dynamic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always been a star vehicle. Every time this production is done, you know, on a major level, it's always a star vehicle, because you have to have such a combination of talent and also look, you know, to do it, you know, and especially when it pertains to the theater, to have the consistency there. And they are just rock stars, mm-hmm. you know, in this production. And you definitely don't want to miss it. We're here until November 1st.
So,
definitely come out and support it. I mean, I promise you, you haven't seen anything like it. You know, I mean, maybe the story you might feel like you've seen, but you've never seen these performances together on the stage, and all together on a stage. It makes for a beautiful gumbo, a beautiful, you know, piece of theater, for sure.
So when you all get together, some of you may know each other. Many of you probably have never met before, and you're doing this this very intimate kind of show. Do you have to get to know each other at all before you perform on stage? Do you know, have little groups of, hi, how are you? Where'd you grow up?
I think it's important. I think it's important to know everyone that, you know, I'm working with, you know. It's, for me, I believe that it's important. And the way that the world works, especially theater and art, it becomes very small. So we have, you know, one degree of separation. Oh, you're so-and-so's friend.
Really?
And so there are points of entry for most of us in the show, and especially the actors who are primarily based out of New York. You know, there are many of us, I've heard so much about you. Pleasure to meet you finally,
nice,
you know.
Nice.
And this type of, the type of talent that you have in this show, people will talk about,
right?
You know. So, you know, when you have people that can do everything and do it so well, or do what they do so well, you know, people will talk about that, because it really is a beautiful production full of amazing talent that, you know, the show requires it. You can't do the show and not have talent.
And no, you
not
can't.
Also have
it
discipline.
It would not be a good show without good talent.
It's about stars. It's about stardom. It's about the music industry. And you have to have star quality in the show and in the performers. And this show, this production at Milwaukee Rep is no different. Mark Clemens did a phenomenal job as a director and being there to hand pick all of these people in this ensemble.
So you're New York now, but you are from Houston?
I'm from Houston, Texas.
You're from Houston, Texas.
Houston.
Yeah, really?
Yes.
You liked it there.
I love Houston.
How come?
Well, you know, growing up there, you know, I was around my family, and I have such amazing family.
Aww.
You know, and it's the food and it's the people that I was surrounded by. Now, I know Texas is Texas now. You know, I won't deny that we are a little challenging, but I love my home. I love my state. And I love the people that I grew up with, for sure. And I'm thankful that they have supported me in being in New York. I've been in New York for 10 years now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just as much of a New Yorker as anything else, you know. But I love where I'm from, for sure.
So is it a hard life? Do you have to audition once this show is over? Will you know what you're going to do next? Or do you have to audition for something else?
Yeah, the auditions never stop.
Hard life, isn't it?
It can be a tough life, but it's the life that I'm choosing for myself.
Right.
And that within itself is exciting. And the variety within the life, you know, and the ability to, again, tell stories that move people, to tell a story that might pose questions or bring up things for people and audience members that they go home. Well, this story, they say, is loosely based on Motown. So they go home and research Berry Gordy, who they might not have ever researched because we're not in the Motown era as far as what is the signature sound. But to see and to know that the stories that I'm telling affect people, that's so cool. And I get to do it around the world. That's so cool, you know? So I don't know if it's hard, but there are tough moments. And yes, when I get back to New York, there are things, you know, that, you know, I'm in the running for, I guess, or, you know, things that I'm looking forward to. And it is just about how do I continue in working within it, you know? That's why I'm happy that I'm humbled and I'm grateful that I have many different ways to practice art in my life. So if I'm not on stage, I can sing. Or if I'm not singing, I can do voiceovers. If I'm not doing voiceovers,
you can still do watercolors, I bet.
I can still do watercolors,
you know,
as an outlet, you know. So, it's rewarding. And I think that I wouldn't say that it was hard. Tough times, tough life sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so rewarding for me.
Well, you're very, very good at it. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you. And the show goes until November 1st. We're going out with Effie singing this song because she's so in love with you.
Hey.
You cast her off, honey. Goodbye, Effie.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, make sure you come out to the Milwaukee Rep Quadrachi Theater.
Great. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks to
KP Whaley for producing this hour and for KP for on-air production. This is I'm Telling You from Dreamgirls. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't want to be free. I'm still. I'm you. You're gonna see?